Last week we started the subject, the difficult subject. Who was not here last Tuesday morning? Who's not been here before? Those who've not been here before. Okay, let's do it like this. We tried to deal with a very difficult subject last week, the subject of suffering, and especially what seems to be meaningless suffering. What should be the Jewish approach to a person or oneself, anybody who happens to be suffering, especially in ways that seem difficult to understand, especially in ways that, as we explained last week, much of a certain segment of human suffering is seemingly, let's say, unavoidable. In other words, there's a certain amount of suffering that is certainly self-inflicted. I mean, the people live very unwisely, okay, in terms of their marriages, in terms of their child raising and education, and many things that people do that, at least as far as we can say, probably had they conducted themselves differently, with a bit more wisdom or a bit more Torah guidance, you might not have had to undergo certain suffering. But then, despite that, there certainly is a whole segment of suffering that, so to speak, one can't avoid, certain illnesses and various things that, without going into the spiritual manipulation of these things, but at least as far as the eye can see, and that kind of suffering, often people go through the agony of the pain, but not only that, they also go through the suffering of not knowing why them. Why? Is this going to speak at me the whole show? We tried to look at that. Now, if you weren't here last week, what I hope to do is this. We discussed then the idea of suffering, and I'll revise just briefly some of just what we need for this morning. But I would suggest that if you weren't here, the only way to really make sense out of this will be to get a recording of that shiur, which hopefully will be in the library in the next day or two. And then you could put the whole subject together, because without that introduction, this will not be a full, will not be full. So what we briefly learned last week, just give me a few minutes to build the overall picture of that and this idea, and then you're welcome to ask questions about more specific, try and leave time for more specific applications of the idea of last week and this week. First of all, we're not trying to explain suffering over here. That's not the point, right? Why bad things happen to good people is a classic question, and you'll find much good Torah that's been said on that subject, on what we can understand and what we can't understand. I think there's a type in the library dealing with that subject specifically, one of the lectures that came from overseas. That has been dealt with actually at a depth that says we can't really understand it, can't really understand the specifics of it necessarily. I think I mentioned cases last week of events and circumstances that I personally had been involved with, where we went to try and find from very great people explanations, and we were told that we're no longer at a level where we can link the specific problem to a specific, let's call it punishment or consequence, to a specific problem anymore. But we can understand a certain amount about the idea of suffering itself. And last week what we said was, very briefly, that the way to approach the whole area is to understand that the baseline of being alive is a tremendous happiness. That was the basic idea, if you remember, that we said. We said that, we brought examples, I'm not going to go through them again, it's worth listening to that discussion, if you need strengthening in this area. There are plenty of examples in Tanakh and in Chazal to show that there were people who had the most intense sufferings, and they lived on a level of ecstasy and happiness just because they happened to be alive. And those who didn't were held accountable. Right? Because if they even show their sufferings in any way, if a person is great enough and they go through the most intense, unbelievable sufferings, and because they're at that level of greatness, what's expected from them is the happiness of manifesting. They should be manifesting the happiness of being alive, just being alive, even in suffering. And if they even let their suffering show a little bit, they were held accountable, as we explained last week, which is an unbelievable level for us, but the idea remains true. What's the idea underlying it is that being alive is not neutral, like most of us think. That's the basic idea. Most of us think that being alive, you didn't ask for it. You know, it's kind of the norm. Sort of, I'm here now. So now let's see whether today is going to be good or bad, what today is going to yield. We said that's not the Torah attitude. The Torah attitude that is that neutral is you're not being here. Your being here for the brief flash of time that we put in this world is very much not neutral at all. In fact, it's so close to the peak of human ecstasy, just being alive, that no matter how bad a person suffers, the fact that they are here should override the sufferings themselves. Now, let's try and take that idea a bit further. Are we all together? That's the basic idea. But how to work it out and how to develop it and how to prove it takes some doing, and that's why I suggest that you listen to that discussion. If you can't get a recording, by the way, last Monday night we dealt with the whole subject, including this section of the talk. To some extent, you can take up that copy, if not last Tuesday. So now let's move into the second phase. The second phase is, so how do you do this thing? How do you actually extract happiness out of sadness? In other words, you're living in an existence that has plenty of sadness to it. Well, perhaps I'm trying to understand that a bit better. But given that you're in this phase, how do you exactly, what do you do every day that enables you to extract the happiness out of being alive? It's all very well to say that you're obliged to do that. And it's all very well to say that theoretically, yes, being alive is a wonderful thing. But practically, when you have loaded down on your narrow shoulders a terrible burden of suffering and guilt and conscience and responsibility, how exactly do you keep smiling and handle things in a positive fashion? Now that's the tough part of the discussion. And we won't be able to handle it fully this morning either, but we'll just try and take one or two things. And it's a broad and vast subject. It's a lifetime's work, this issue. It's not something that you discuss once and then you walk out smiling. It might get worse before it gets better. Let's try. The first idea that a person has to know, that the Bala and Musa talk about, we this is a connection from last week. We began this idea last week. Let's start with a connection and then move on. The first idea that a person has to know is that in the midst of suffering, there's plenty of happiness. Okay? In other words, are you focusing? Is a person focusing on the sadness to the exclusion of the happiness? Are they allowing themselves to become overwhelmed by those elements and areas of their lives that are sad? Yep. And they're disregarding the happy areas? Now, this, that's, in other words, a person must have the balance of focus to look at each thing for what it is. That's a schizophrenic requirement that the Jew is required to be able to do. Let's try and understand this, first of all. You'll see that in most cases, the suffering that a person encounters, actually, you do have the ability to switch off. You do have the ability to switch off and enjoy what you can enjoy when you can. For example, a lot of suffering that people are aware of is not their own suffering. Right? And on the contrary, in this area, we're not sensitive enough. On the contrary, in this area, we should feel more the pain than we do. We are too insensitive. We tend too easily to switch off and enjoy our own happiness while somebody else is suffering badly. And that's a very un-Jewish thing to do. If you have any real sensitivity, the question becomes, if you're really sensitive about it, the question becomes, how can you enjoy anything in your life and have any happiness out of the good fortune that you have when the person next to you doesn't have exactly that thing which you have? Those things that you take for granted, those elements that you do take, the simple things in life that you take for granted, there's so many people close to you. There's nobody, I don't believe there's anybody who doesn't have a lot of people, at least somebody, very close to them, closely related to them, who doesn't have the most intense pain and suffering and sense of lack or loss at the lack of basic things that they don't have that you might have. So the question now is, for you to go out and be happy about those things, you have to be very insensitive. How can you fully enjoy what it is that you have when somebody else that you know well doesn't have that thing, or that person suffering or sick or terminally ill or doesn't have the basic necessities that you have? On the contrary, when you think about them and when you relate to them, we should be more sensitive than we are. By the way, in certain mystical sources, it says that if you are sensitive enough to these things, you may not have to go through them yourself. You know that one of the ideas of being sick, is to teach you a certain thing that you needed to learn. Your own vulnerability, or certain, many things that illness can teach a person. We're not talking about punishment, there's no such thing. There is no such thing in Judaism as punishment as a retribution or vindictive thing. There just is no such thing. Punishment in Judaism, we use that word, a terrible English translation, it's a correction or an opportunity to learn something or an opportunity and a stimulus to grow higher than you were before. It's always got a positive outcome. In fact, if you could trace it to its root, you'd see that it's all chesed. It's all Hashem's kindness. And we don't see it that way when it happens. But it is all His kindness. And therefore, illness, for example, is definitely because you need to do something about it or learn something. So there are commentaries who say that if you go visit somebody who's sick, and you really understand what they're going through, you may never have to get sick yourself. Because the point of sickness is a certain message. And if you get the message, so what do you need to, you don't need to give you the message anymore. If you get the message, you start living that way. So on the contrary, when you visit somebody, And you have to empathize, you have to connect with you. You have to actually teach yourself how to experience what they're going through. And there's halachas of Bikkur Cheilu. It's not just sitting there and talking aimlessly. There are halachas, there are things you have to do. It actually says in Bikkur Cheilu that if there are certain spiritual requirements that are met, you actually take away some of the illness. In the Shulchan Aruch even it says that if you have a certain spiritual connection with that person in certain ways, it could be astrological, it could be age, different opinions about it, you take away a 60th of their illness when you visit them. So if you do it correctly, you could actually benefit in such a way, you could benefit them, and you could benefit in such a way you might not need to go to. So there, on the contrary, the trick is not to switch yourself off and become insensitive. The trick is to, yes, become sensitive. But when you're not relating to that person, and this is where the difficulty arises, when you're not with them or when you're not relating to them, then you have to learn to switch on a happiness that manifests itself, that's completely unperturbed by the sadness that you've just been experiencing. And that's a very difficult thing to do. Let's try and understand that first of all before we get to a deeper level. First of all, you should know that you're never allowed to switch on the happiness. If you really want to know technically, you're never allowed to switch on the happiness. I think we mentioned this last week. You're never allowed to switch on happiness in the external world that's unreserved. Okay? That's halacha. You should know that no Jew is allowed to laugh in this world with complete abandon, absolute, complete, full laughter, because that's just not appropriate. They're just this world itself, the sadness that's going on since Adam did what he did. The sadness that's going on is too great for you ever to manifest that. And the very fact that this world is given to sadness, the very fact that it's finite, the very fact that it's only temporary, itself means that there's no justification for that. And that's why it says, "Batisak liyon acharon," that a woman of spiritual greatness will laugh at the day of death, but not until then. Be correctly prepared. That's when you really start laughing. We don't see it that way, but that's the way it is. Or it says, "Azimal eschayt pinu." It says in Tehillim, then our mouth will be filled with laughter, but not before. And the commentaries learn from that in this world you may not manifest laughter completely in this world. Right? However, you may feel it completely in the heart, and that's an obligation. I think we mentioned this briefly last week. To laugh it out, to laugh it out openly in the world is just downright insensitivity. But to feel it in the heart, that your heart should be bursting with happiness that's uncontrollable in any circumstance, that's allowed and it's an obligation. There's a time for mourning, as we pointed out last week. There's never allowed depression. Mourning, yes, depression not. Sadness, yes, it's appropriate at certain times and has to be manifest. Depression, which means the despair of falling into an inability to act, which is what depression is, because of sadness or because of perplexity and confusion, that's never allowed. Has to be fought like anything. There are Hasidic sources that say it's worse than the worst sin, although it's not prohibited. It does not say thou shalt not be depressed anyway, and yet it's worse than any sin because it leads you to many other levels of destruction. But inner happiness, the Chazon Ish, I think I mentioned, says in one place that if a person understands the light of the truth, amazing, unbelievable statement. The Chazon Ish says in one place that if a person understands the light of the truth in the world, it's not possible to be sad. There's no such thing as sadness if a person understands what the world is and what life is. Try to understand how man could say such a thing. So lesson one is this, that you need the schizophrenic ability to be able to not manifest happiness completely on the outside. Now, don't think you have to walk around with a long face. On the contrary, it's an obligation, especially of a Jewish woman and a Jewish mother, to be very upbeat, to be very positive in her outlook, especially when there's suffering going on around her. On the contrary, that's exactly what's needed. When she shows the weight of the suffering, children learn to complain. Children learn how to be failures in the world. On the contrary, when a Jewish woman is going through suffering in her own personal and even intimate sphere, and when it's due to other people in the broader sphere that are around her, and children are aware that she's going through that, and they see that she smiles, that she acts positively with spring in her step, they learn how to be successful in the world. So you at least have that message to teach. Definitely you have to be very much on the happy side of neutral. Now the thing is, you may not go to the extreme, that's all. You may not walk around as if you're living in the next world, as if everything's blissfully happy. That you may not do. But about as close to that as you can get is allowed, believe me. So you've got to work to get as close as you can. And in your heart you feel that. In your heart that's what you have to feel. So the first thing is this, that it takes a schizophrenic ability. You have to be able to behave sadly on one occasion, and you have to still feel the happiness, and you have to move into the next phase. It might be on one side of the door. On this side of the door you're being Menachem Avil, Le'alani, you have to comfort somebody who's sad, and then you might have to go on the other side to do something happy, and you have to be happy about it. That's required from a Jew. You have to do that. Nobody said life's easy. Nobody said life's easy, not for resting and being neutral or being sad. There are sources in Torah that say that you have to develop the ability to switch off completely from one situation when you're living the next. Because most of us make the mistake that while we're living in one situation, we don't switch off others. So we don't do this one properly, and of course you're not doing that one properly either. the classic basis of it, the Balai Musa bring out, is that when you're doing one particular situation, what happens is most of us regret the fact that we're doing it because we think we should be doing another one. And the classic example is a yeshiva man. He's in yeshiva. Now his wife's struggling at home and she needs him. You know, this is a personal, job that anybody's working in yeshiva knows. His wife's at home and she needs him. Now he's got this dilemma. Should he be out there learning Torah, which is actually for the benefit of the two of them, and let her struggle? Or should he be home helping her and give up his Torah learning that day, which means the two of them are giving up the merit of their Torah learning, which is the mitzvah. So the normal response is whichever he does it badly. He either sits in yeshiva and he's so worried about what an unkind individual he is and how much his wife needs him that he doesn't concentrate, he doesn't learn at all. And he doesn't help her. And then if he goes home to help her, he makes her life an utter misery and he makes her feel guilty that because of her and because she's not stronger, he's unable to learn. And he makes a wreck of whatever he does. The trick of successful living is to have that schizophrenic ability to do whatever you decide to do, and you decide that Hashem wants this from me. This is what Hashem wants. He's put me in an ordeal. Of course he's caught me in a crossfire where it's difficult to decide, but once I've decided, and there's a whole process of how you decide these things, I'm not going to go into that now, this is what he wants me to do. And because he wants me to do this, I do it properly and completely and give my heart to it. Rabbi Miller from Gateshead once gave the most incredible example. It's a frightening example. Is that once there was a Sheva Brochus in Gateshead, and I think it was the Rov of Gateshead, one of the great rabbis of the time, was saying a Dvar Torah at the Sheva Brochus. Listen to this unbelievable thing. There he was, the people were happy, the Chassan and Kala were there, it was the Sheva Brochus, he was saying a Dvar Torah, he didn't feel well. So he excused himself and he went out and collapsed. Outside the door, he collapsed, and he had a massive heart attack. Okay? Outside the door of the room where the Sheva Brochus were. Inside they were dancing to make the Chassan and Kala happy, and outside they were trying to resuscitate a dying man. And some people had to do both. You hear that? There were people that had to do both. They stayed outside doing their share to try and revive him. They were giving him the kiss of life and trying to revive him. And when they couldn't carry on anymore, they had to step inside the door, smile, and start dancing for the Chassan and Kala, without letting them know what was going on. And they had to switch backwards and forwards within minutes. That's what's required. What can you do? That's what the world is. You think it's just that side of a door and this side of a door. The world's like that. Just because you happen to be sitting in this room, I promise you, 5 minutes from here on any side, you can come across the most intense human suffering that's going on. So how can you sit here and just close your eyes to it and just become blind to it? So the trick is that while you're here, you do it properly. And you cross through that door and you go into that world and you do that properly. But the tragic mistake is to carry that one here. Then you don't do anything properly. It's inappropriate to take happiness over there, you know, certain manifestations. And of course you can't take that here. You're paralyzed into inaction. Anybody who feels the sadness of what's going on in life intensely will be paralyzed into inaction. You can't do that. You have to learn how. Now, let's take the next step. The next step is actually much worse and much better also. Let's understand. You see, the sadness of this life, it's not just that there are people who are suffering. That's not what's sad about it. People think that, you know, this is a difficult world and it's a sad world because, unfortunately, this one's suffering and that one's suffering and this is happening. That's not the point. The point is that the world inherently is a place of sadness. The world inherently is a place of tremendous sadness because it's finite. Let's understand that anybody in this... I'm not going to go into the mystical background. That's not for today. The mystics say that the world itself is sad because it's limited and finite, whereas Hashem, who's manifesting this world, is infinite. If Adam would have realized, it says... This is, again, if Adam HaRishon would have realized the sadness of a world that was created in the midst of the beauty and happiness of the world, that means had he been created in that wonderful garden where he had no problems and everything was fantastic, in that moment had he realized the sadness of Hashem's infinite oneness having to compress itself down, as it were, into a finite world, right? Had he realized that, what's called Golas HaShchina, it says he would have been Yotzi Chiyuv of sadness for all eternity. That means he would have fulfilled the obligation of exile. And nobody would have ever had to be sad again. Had he realized that there's something finite here being made out of an infinite, and that itself spiritually is a terribly, terribly sad thing. It's Hashem being divorced from his own skin or whatever that means. Had he realized that, we would have never had to have an exile. But because it looked so good to him, and he didn't realize fully at his level exactly what that was, so the exile had to get really painful. And then it had to get brutal. And then it had to get to its dismal and abysmal situation that it's in now, and we're still not realizing it. But apart from the mystical level, what do we understand from that? That the very creation of the world is a sad thing because it's finite. And if you understand it if you understand it correctly, there's tremendous potential for sadness in a human life. Because anybody who really understands what their life is realizes that every second is just a minute closer to the time you won't be here anymore. And that is a sadness. In other words, yes, there are sources that say that a person should understand that in the moment of greatest ecstasy actually is the greatest sadness. Actually, the moments of greatest ecstasy are the most short-lived of all. And they contain within them the greatest sadness imaginable. Because as the climax of an experience is with one, one realizes, as sharply as one realizes the experience, one realizes that it's about to be over. Any sensitive mother looking at her children, you'll see sometimes a mother of great sensitivity at a moment of great happiness, are uncontrollable tears sometimes. Because you understand that this is slipping by. That it's only a moment that you waited so long to reach this, and it's already over. As you begin to apprehend it, it's already over. And when a person looks back, I'm sorry to make you sad, you just have to understand the sadness of it before we can understand how to deal with it. When a person looks back over their life, how all the years that you've been here, when you started out and you were 15, it looked like an infinity in front of you. It was endless, there was no problem at all. But you look back now, on whatever age you are, on whatever years have gone by, it's unbelievable. There's nothing of it. It's a faint memory. It's just a flicker of memory. Where is it now? Where is the tangible reality? It just isn't here. And you think when you're 120 years old, that flash of memory seems longer? It doesn't seem longer. It seems shorter, if anything. The longer you go, the more the past dissolves into an unbelievable instant of memory. That's terribly sad. It means that all this richness of life that you experience, actually at any time when you try and stop for a moment and grasp it and see what it is that you've done, where is it actually? Where is this rich fabric of life actually isn't here at all? Just an illusion. So how can you ignore that as you go through life? Everything that you do, you realize that it's just one step closer to that. That's the problem. That's the problem. Now, the way to deal with it, the Jewish way to deal with it, is this. We don't understand that the way to deal with it is to ignore it. That's not the idea. We don't try and ignore it. And we don't try and get around it and just hope it'll soon be over. And that all the sadness, the way to deal with the sadness is to get out of the area of the sadness. That's not what we do. We try and extract the happiness out of the sadness. That's a Jewish challenge. That has to be understood. So understand. What you want is the finite experience. What you want and what you should relish is the limited experience. And what you should draw out of the sadness is the happiness. And that's where you should look for the happiness. So understand this. Very, very remarkable idea. This takes a spiritual sensitivity. It takes working. One has to work on oneself intensely, and one has to work on oneself even harder in times of trouble to get this message, but that's what a person has to do. I'll start off like this. There are commentaries who say that it's the very apprehension, it's the very grasp of the limited nature of the situation from where you get your happiness. First, we have to understand that first. It's when you understand that the whole thing is temporary, that itself gives it a sweetness that's unbelievable. You have to know that that sweetness can only be felt when you know that the temporary nature of the thing is going on to a permanent nature. Otherwise, there's no hope at all. That has to be clear. The person thinks that this temporary life is all there is. Okay, and they're trying to extract some happiness out of it, then you don't belong here. There's no, that we can't talk about that. If you think that after this it all disappears, and you're still worried about it, if you think it disappears after this, so who cares, then you're doing fine. Don't speak to me about it. But if you think that after this it all disappears, and you're worried about it, and you feel sad because that moment's getting closer, that, and you think that at the end there's nothing, then it's truly hopeless. Then it is truly hopeless. Nothing. There's no hope for you. There's no hope for such a person. How do you comfort such a person who feels the sweetness of life, and he feels that every moment that he experiences the sweetness is closer to being over, and when it's over it will be over forever, and he feels that's a sadness? There's no hope for such a person. The only hope, the only way you can extract the happiness out of the sadness is to know that every moment that you're building now that slips by so quickly that you can't grasp it is going to come back as an eternity. That's the happiness. And it's the very fact that it just slipped away that's what you love about it. It's the very fact that it slipped away that you only had it for one instant. You had this morning only once. You had this morning of your life, you had only for one morning. The very fact that it only lasted you, that is what gives it its sweetness. If you know that it's going to be translated into permanence. Try and understand this. First of all, you can understand this through a marshal very beautifully. And I think another once put it like this. Very, very beautiful way of putting it. He said, if you ever go on holiday to a resort, if you ever go on holiday, you go to a place where it's a beautiful resort in the mountains, where there's all beautiful, wonderful things to do and sights to see, and a very, very beautiful place. If you look at the people in that place, you'll note something remarkable. You'll see that the people who are there on holiday enjoy it unbelievably. They take in the scenery, and they take deep breaths of the fresh air, and they're like amazed by the whole experience. The people who live there all year, I think it's pretty dull. They live there all the time. They should be the one. They should be ecstatic. They have this all the time. But no, they're completely insensitive to the experience. So they will come. You know where they go on their holidays? Where you came from. That's where they go. The smelly, dirty, polluted places that you're trying to get away from, they go on holiday. In other words, what happens is when a person's in a situation of beauty in terms of permanence, you don't feel it anymore. That's what happens. You think the people who live in a holiday resort, you think they go canoeing in the river, you think they ride the horses, you think they climb the mountains. They don't do anything like it. It's nothing to interest them less. But it's when you've only got 2 weeks there that you make sure you get everything out of it. You follow what happens. When you're passing through and you're aware that you're passing through, you make the most of it. You drink it in deeply. The person who thinks they're here forever, the person who thinks that this goes on forever, they're the ones who just get tremendous sadness out of this place. They just can't get the happiness out of it. A person who realizes that he's here only for a finite time, that it's slipping away. A few weeks that I'm here, that's all. Who knows when it's going to end? I can't afford to let a minute go by that I don't use. You see, it says in the next world, it says in the Gemara, that one of the questions they ask you when you pass into the next world is, why didn't you taste the fruit of that tree? In other words, there was a pleasure that was put in the world for you to enjoy, and you didn't enjoy it. You're held accountable for that. Now you can understand it. You're here for a limited space of time. It's put here to be drunk from deeply and richly. You were here and you didn't bother to do that. Well, exactly why? Did you think you'd have some time? Well, in 1,000 years' time, when did you think exactly you'd get out of that? 1,000 years' time or 2,000 years? When exactly did you think you were going to do that? You've got to do it now. You've got to get out and enjoy it and benefit and translate all that finite sweetness into infinity. When a person lives that way, do you know what difference it makes to a day? You know, this is not a view that you have to have on the long term. Having it on the long term is just too philosophical. You must have it on a daily basis. You've got to get up in the morning, you must make a little sign about this. You follow? Just make a little note about this. Otherwise, you'll definitely forget. If you walk out of here thinking that that's a great idea, I promise you, tomorrow morning, it's not going to hit you when you wake up. I promise you, tomorrow morning you're going to wake up and say, Levi, today shouldn't be worse than yesterday. That's how you're going to wake up tomorrow morning. But you put this little sign above your bed. As you open your eyes, you see this little sign reminding you how to relate to today. And the way you relate to today is like this. Look, today might be the last day, right? I don't know. Who knows? And the truth is, it is going to be the last day. It will never come again, that day. That day will never come again. Today, as young as you are, the age that you are, with the potential that you have, the fact that you can walk, that you can see, whatever it is, you'll never have that again, this day of that. So you say to yourself, I can't afford to miss it. You leap out of bed. Can't afford to miss a minute. What will happen at the end of your life when a person's consciousness is slipping away for the last time? And they think back over that hour or 2 hours that they did nothing, or they walked around miserable. Can you imagine the agony of that? Can you imagine the agony that you're about to lose it now? And you suddenly think back on the hours and hours and hours and hours and days that you actually didn't use, and now you don't have any left? You hear? Therefore, you've got to say to yourself, listen, this will never come again today. Today has got to be a day that I take the finite nature of today. That means it's going to pass from this morning to this evening. I'm going to go to sleep tonight. It will then just be a flash of memory that will never come again. I have to extract out of it everything that will remain with me forever. I can't afford to waste a minute of it. Certainly a person should at least think they can't afford to waste a day. Start making calculations about minutes. That can get too complicated. It can become abnormal. But at least a day, at least a goal for the day. How many people make a goal for the day? I mean, what a waste. You should go to bed at night, you should sit on your bed at night, and you should say to yourself, what did I do today? And you should have tremendous happiness out of what you achieved, and you should encourage yourself because of it, and you should have tremendous honesty about what you failed today, and you should berate yourself for it, and you should make a goal, a game plan for tomorrow. I mean, the most basic thing is that if a person was in business, or in sport, or anything in life, you make a goal, you make a plan, don't you? Don't you make a plan? An intelligent wife should make a plan about a marriage, about a child raising. You should make a plan. What are you going to do today? How are you going to do it? You should have these things planned out. You shouldn't be caught unawares. An intelligent woman plans things out. Isn't that right? You should have a fantastic supper in the freezer always. Isn't that right? And you should make your husband buy you a microwave, and you should have the supper in the freezer. So that on that day when things just get out of hand and complicated and somebody needs your attention and your kindness and so forth, right, that you're still coming out smiling at the end of the day. You'll come out 1 second before your husband does and have a fantastic spread laid on. He won't even know that what you went through today. You plan it out. If you don't plan it, you'll be a wreck. So you plan anything else, but your life, you don't bother to plan. What do? You wake up every morning sort of in a vague fuzz, you know, of apprehension about what, isn't that right? But does that make any sense? You're not going to get this day again. Before you go to sleep, you make a plan. If necessary, you write it out. And you say to yourself, tomorrow, goal is, smile all day. That's goal number one. Okay, smile all day, no matter what. and you put your makeup on like that, okay? And then goal number two, you know, let's say accept it, kindness. You're not going to get breakfast till you've done an act of kindness. And you have your goals, simple goals to start with. At the end of the day, you sit down on your bed and you say, okay, did I achieve it or didn't I? And you have to have a sense of achievement of what you did. There's no question about it. Now, let's take the next step. It's getting a bit better, yeah? Now, the next step is this. That's not just out of the sadness of the awareness of the temporary nature of life that you expect the happiness, but out of the very sadness itself. It's trying to understand that now. You see, the moments of greatest suffering are the moments of greatest ordeal. And it's ordeal that you face which is what builds what you are eternally. The days when everything goes easy, when you lay on the beach all day, relax. Some guy said, how a person copes with disfigurement, or he asked him about the person who is disabled. A handicap, yes, a severe handicap. So Rav Miller said to him that in the next world that will be your greatest happiness. That will be your greatest happiness, that will be your treasure in the next world. I didn't understand it at the time, but obviously, that's the person's ordeal. That's what they had to cope with. That's what they had to achieve happiness with, and through that they had to achieve happiness. That's what made them unique. Now it's their biggest limitation. But in the next world, the places where they had it easy, where they had no limitation at all, they don't count for anything. It's the resistance that they worked against, right? If you want a crude example, it's a person who puts his effort into sport, let's say. I'm not suggesting it, but a person who does that. And he sweats and strains for hours on end. His happiness in the end is all the work that he put in. What he treasures at the end is the effort that he put in. Not the time that he took a break. That's meaningless to him, you follow? It's the time that he put the effort in. Or when a person does well in exams or whatever it is, and they feel it's because they put a certain amount of effort in. So the happiness afterwards is the effort. That's what they relish now. Let's try and understand how this works. The first step is to understand how it works. The next step is to work on it so that this can follow you through life. The idea is as follows. Yeah, it will start with a spiritual idea. Wonderful if a person can grasp this. The idea is that every reality in the world has two dimensions. It has a dimension of its limited nature, which is sad, and it has a dimension of its expanded nature, which is eternal and happy. The very same thing. Hashem doesn't give you a world. Hashem doesn't play games with us. That he gives us a world that is so sad that all you want to do is get through it. That the happiness will be because this world has ended. There's no such thing. The happiness will be not because this... The happiness that we'll experience, the real genuine happiness in life, is not the happiness of the sadness being over. The happiness will be the happiness that the sadness becomes happiness. You understand? It says that in the next world, just to give you an example, it says in the next world, what you'll see is trees. Again, it doesn't mean that, but in the analogy, trees. But the difference is that the trees of Gan Eden, this beautiful garden of trees, the unusual feature of the trees is that the tree and the fruit taste the same. That's what it says. You'll be able to eat the tree, you'll be able to eat the fruit, it won't make any difference. What that means? It means, listen carefully, it's the most unbelievable idea. In this world you have a tree that you can't eat. What's the tree do? It's a means to bring out the fruit you can eat. There's a pathway, and then there's an end result. There's a means, and there's an end. The means is only a means. The means, when you spend time working towards something, the working towards something is so that you get the something in the end. The working towards is not sweet. The working towards is something you have to go through. The tree has to grow to bring out a fruit. But in the next world, everything is fruit. Everything is beauty and sweetness. Everything is the fruit. But the depth of it means this. It doesn't say that in the next world it's all fruit. It doesn't say that you walk around and there'll be enormous fruits all over. It doesn't say that. There'll be trees. But the trees will be the fruit. It means that the effort that you put in now will reveal itself to be the fruit itself. You thought you were putting the effort to get to a certain point. Years and years and years of effort and you got to that point. In the next world what will be revealed to you is that the end point will be fruit, will be sweet, but all the years of effort that you put in to get there, there'll be fruit just as much as that. It means everything that you thought was just a slaving and a working towards something, not that the happiness of the fruit will be that Baruch Hashem, now that's over. And it'll be the relief of having the work over. That's not the idea. The work itself will reawaken. You'll see the work itself reveal itself as fruit itself, as the end result. On the contrary, that'll be the greatest sweetness. The greatest sweetness will be all the work that you put in that you thought was just a means to an end. You'll see that that's the end in itself. All the work you did on yourself to overcome sadness, right, to maintain, yes? You thought that you worked on yourself for days and hours to overcome a situation. And then you managed to achieve something. Now you're proud of the achievement. In the next world, the days and weeks that you worked, that'll be the happiness. Because that's what's wanted in the next world. The simple happiness isn't what's wanted. What's wanted is the hard work you put in to cope with it.
Couple of difficulties. Let's understand. How do you see this? The Gemara has a remarkable, there's a remarkable thing. The Gemara talks about measurements, unbelievable things. The Gemara talks about measurements, technical measurements of length. And there's a measurement called a tefach. Tefach is this, the hand's breadth. That's one hand's breadth is a tefach. Isn't that 8 or 9 centimeters, 10 centimeters? That's a tefach, a hand's breadth. Then the Gemara says there's two kinds. Unbelievable idea. There's what's called a tefach atuk, that's this. And there's one called a tefach seichek, which is this. Where the fingers are spread slightly, and it's just slightly more than the ordinary tefach. There's two kinds. And you have to know, when you're building, and the instructions given as to how to build something in the Torah, you have to know whether you're measuring by tefachim that are called atuvim, that are these closed ones, or open ones, which are called a tefach seichek, which is a little bit more. Now, the remarkable thing about this is as well. First of all, tefach atuv means a sad tefach. Sad. Atuv means it's sad. Tefach seichek means a smiling one. A tefach that smiles. It's happy. Now this isn't simple children's stories. This is deep spiritual secrets. What does it mean? And why on earth would the Torah call two different measurements by the same name? Why do they call it tefach? If these are two different measurements, call one something and add something else. Call this a tefach and call that something else. This is called an amma. So call it, you've got plenty of names, you're not short of names. Why would the Torah, listen carefully, it's the most unbelievable secret. Why would the Torah call two different measurements? They're different measurements. There's a whole finger's difference between them. One is 9 and one is 11 centimeters, let's say. Two different measurements. Why get confusing and call them both by the same name? You hear the problem. Give them two different names. Anybody would do that. The idea is that the same thing itself in the world, the very same thing can reveal itself in a sad way, and the very same thing can reveal itself as happiness. And the only way to get to the happiness is to expand the sadness. That's what it means. How do you see it? What does it mean in practicality? The only way to get happiness, the only way to build the next world, the only way to build that dimension of happiness, which is the next world, and which is what you can already appreciate here when you know you're building it, is that when you understand that the squeezed, narrow dimension of the sad in this world is actually expanding, if you use it correctly, into happiness. What could be happier than that? Imagine as you go through a difficult ordeal, and you know that every moment of this ordeal, that every difficulty, every aspect of difficulty that it's giving you, is your spiritual being. Everything that's happening here is what Hashem wants from you. And everything that's happening here, you're going to enjoy eternally. And the sadder it is now, the worse it is, and the more difficult, the greater the ecstasy is going to be of this moment. How would a person feel if they had to go through something? Let's say a person loves somebody very much. A woman, let's say, she loves her husband. Now she has to go through fire and water to do something for him, to get to him, let's say. How would she feel? How would a person feel, is that right? Who's going through terrible, terrible difficulty, and they have to get someplace, and they don't know where they're going. You follow? Here's this woman, or here's this man, whoever it is, they have to find each other now to build their life together. And they know that the other person's there. And they have to fight through the most intense difficulties to get there. There are thousands and thousands of miles of danger and difficulty. So what happens? If the person doesn't know where they're going, what could be a bigger agony? Imagine chasing through the jungle, fending off cobras and whatever it is, without knowing where you're going. It could be nice. Sit down and die. There's no other option. Why struggle? You struggle on and on and on and don't know where you're going. What could be sadder? But imagine if you know where you're going. You know you're going to build a beautiful thing, that it will all be appreciated, it will be intense happiness forever. So every step forward, you relish every step forward, no? You find the strength in yourself to cope with it, and you relish it, and every step forward is a new achievement. Instead of saying, there's another moment of sadness, and another moment of sadness, how long will I be battered by this? Every step forward becomes a moment of achievement. And you can think to yourself, you're one step closer. Isn't that the way it works? So a person, when they go through ordeals, and something terrible happens in a family, or something terrible happens with people around, anything that it is, or health-wise, or whatever it is, financially or health or whatever kind of circumstances it is. So a person feels the pain of it. There's no question about it. It's a struggle. But a person senses that one day this is going to turn. This itself is going to turn into happiness. It's an unbelievable idea. The mystics bring it out in the following way. Just give two examples and we'll leave it at that. Where do you feel it? Where do you actually feel this? If you experience your own feeling of happiness, you know, you can do this in two ways. You can do it intellectually, as we're trying to work out now, but you can actually feel where you feel it. The spiritual, mystical pathway is always that Hashem gives you an example in this world where you actually feel the spiritual reality. Like, you want to know about the next world, you experience Shabbos. You want to know about... There's an example and a place in the world where you can... Where can you actually feel... Listen well, you have to hear this well. Where can you actually feel in this world that genuine happiness means a lifting yourself from one level to the next? If you think about it, you'll see that what makes you happy, what gives a person tremendous happiness, is always when their reality expands. Is that right? When you as a person expand to a higher level, that's when you feel happy. What makes a person happy in the world? Let's say having a child. What's the happiness of having a child? What's the happiness of having a child? It's a big responsibility. It's a big responsibility, right? It's difficult, it's going to keep you up at night. A lot of responsibility and difficulty. What's the happiness? The happiness is you just expand it to an incredible degree. Your own being, your own self, your own being expanded into the world in unbelievable way. New human beings in the world. It's an unbelievable happiness. A person gets married. What's marriage? You now expand from your own being, your unlimited sphere, into a being of two. It's tremendous happiness. When a person achieves a certain thing, when they do a certain thing that leads them to a new level of achievement, why do they feel happy? Because they knew they're a greater version of themselves than they were before. You know what the mystics say? That if you really want to explore this, there's a remarkable thing. A remarkable thing is this. When a person feels one of those moments of happiness, what does he wish to do? To drink wine. Know that? No, women might not experience that so much. Women might want to drink wine at the opposite extremes. I don't know. But men, right, there's a unique experience that a person wants to drink wine. The person wants to take it. Why do we take a drink at happy moments? You know, a strange thing. I could understand if you gave me a big bottle of whiskey, a big glass of whiskey at a sad moment. Not anesthetize me. I understand that. Makes sense to me. And it turns out that is one of the purposes of wine. But the point is, why when a person experiences something very happy, do you wish to take wine? On the contrary, now's the moment when I'm full and rich in myself. I don't need to change my consciousness. Isn't it a remarkable thing? Why does a person take wine at a moment? Why do you have a drink at a happy occasion? Why? Do you wish to forget about it? The idea is this. Then what you're trying to do is, listen carefully, it's the most unbelievable Kabbalistic idea. When your neshama expands to new dimension, you almost feel that you're going out of your kalim. You almost feel that the kalim can't hold that new level. And you want to take something to make the kalim, to make the vessels expand. You want to be able to hold this happiness at a higher level. You wish to have a consciousness that expands to the extent that the new level of growth and happiness can actually fill it. You follow that? You feel that the happiness takes you to a level where you're actually constrained in your own consciousness. So you take wine because you know it will expand the consciousness. It will expand the lower level of the vessel in the mind to the point that it can absorb and hold more of this happiness. Of course, it has to be done carefully. It has to be done carefully. Because wine... Are we together? So the mystics say, why do you see it in wine? This is one of the most beautiful things a person could ever understand. Is because wine, alcohol, is that medium that if you take it in its physical form, if you have enough of it, it will make you much more physical and limited than you were before. It's got the unique ability, it's remarkable, it's got the unique property that if you overdo it, if you get into it for its own sake, it makes you very depressed. Very depressed. It drops you to the level of the physical until your consciousness is gone completely. But if you take it correctly, in the correct doses, it lifts you to a new level of consciousness. That's the unbelievable paradox of wine. That's why wine doesn't obey all the spiritual rules, all the physical rules, you're aware of that. You know, it says that other things in the world, the older they get, the worse they get. Everything else in the world wears away as it gets old. That's the nature of the world. But wine gets better as it gets old. Because it's in the spiritual world already, so it obeys the rules of spirituality. The opposite rules to the physical. And therefore, when a person takes wine, if you handle it correctly, instead of making you more physical, this thing that has the power, the ability to make you very physical and limit you, if you take it correctly, what happens is it expands you. The same message again. It's the same reality that when used correctly expands. It's not something else. You don't avoid the physical to become happy. You take that which is the most potent aspect of physicality. That which can take a human being right into physicality and you see it all around you. And that's what a Jew takes. That's the Jewish secret. The Jewish secret is you take that thing which is the most powerful connection to physicality and you take it in just the right dose and you relate to it in just the correct way that it expands you to a new dimension. And of course that's why halakhically we take wine at all moments that expand us from one dimension to the next. When do we take wine? At a bris. A bris is a time when you take a child and you do something physical to lift into spirituality. So we take wine. Or a marriage. A marriage is a time when you take two people to reach a new level. We take wine. Kiddush. Kiddush on Friday night. What is that? It's where the week, which is limited and finite, becomes the infinity of Shabbos. So we take wine then. Any transition from one dimension to another, the message being, not that we leave behind the old dimension. On the contrary, the message is that we expand the other dimension. You know, people think that Shabbos is Baruch Hashem, the week's over. That's what people think. People think that Shabbos is that now the week's finished, you can relax on Shabbos and enjoy it. That's not Shabbos. Shabbos means enjoying the week. I don't know if you know that. Shabbos means enjoying the pleasure of feeling what you did in the week. Do you know that whenever the Torah talks about Shabbos, it says you shall work for 6 days first? You know that? The Torah doesn't say have Shabbos. The Torah says work for 6 days and have Shabbos. So the commentaries say it means that the only way you can have Shabbos is you work for 6 days. The way you build that eternal dimension is through the work that you do to get there. That is building the eternal dimension. So that's all. They go even further. I'm not going to go through this in detail. I don't want to keep you late. Havdalah is the same thing. Havdalah is the end of Shabbos. That's actually it. Interesting problem, because Havdalah you come down, you don't go up. Havdalah you have a sadness of Shabbos leaving. So why do you take wine then? You hear the question. Avdala, you're leaving behind Shabbos and you're coming down to a physical dimension. So the mystics say, absolutely wrong. Absolutely wrong! What happens when Shabbos goes? If you're on a low level, what happens when Shabbos goes? You feel sad and you drop. But if you're working on yourself spiritually, you relish leaving Shabbos into the next week. Here's the opportunity to build again. The next week isn't a drop, it's a new spiral up to a higher Shabbos than the one that was before. Shabbos isn't like up and then you drop into the week, and then up and then you drop again. That's not like that. Shabbos is a time when you consolidate the week and you reach a level you never were at before. Now you move ahead into the next week and you build higher to the next Shabbos. And your whole life is a spiral of going higher and higher. So Havdalah is a time when the sadness of the spiritual world leaving you is felt, but incredible surge of energy that now you come out of the dimension of relaxation and of not achieving and of not doing. And now you get your gears meshed and you get your feet stuck into doing what it is that the next week is a tremendous happiness. On the contrary, that's the happiness of this world. The happiness of this world is exactly that you can take the suffering of this world. But you're here to do it. On the contrary, there are many people who suffer, they just wish they were out of it. If they have the courage to, they take themselves out of it. That's terrible from a Jewish point of view. The last thing in the world you want is to be out of this. When you're out of this, sure you're resting, but you can't do anything. Everything you want is this limited ability to do. It's only this limited ability that you have now to do something with your life that's able to translate that finite flash of nothing into an eternity, into an infinity. That's why great people who lived on a level of spiritual perfection, they never wanted to go to the next world, they wanted to live. It says in the Gemara in Shabbos that when the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, came to take Moses, came to take Moshe, and he beat him off. He wouldn't let him take him. He beat him off. And King David, the angel had to make a very clever special plan to take his life because these people didn't want to die. Why not? Why not be together with Hashem? Why not? You live the life of perfection and it's over. Why not be with Hashem? No, they couldn't handle it. They wanted one more second to have time in this world to do for themselves, to build themselves. Because being with Hashem, you're only with Hashem to the extent that you built it here. It's not just get it over as quickly as possible so you can enjoy the reward. There is no reward if that's the way you do it. The reward is only the tree tastes like the fruit only where there was a tree here. It's only those extra moments of doing extra mitzvahs, of building yourself spiritually, of handling difficulty, and bringing yourself from the level of sadness. But that is exactly what the next world is. And therefore, a person on the contrary wants as much of this as possible. There's plenty of time for the next world. Plenty of time. One great Reviton. So once saw her husband sit down and just give a sigh, sat in his chair and gave a sigh and closed his eyes. She said, what are you doing? Where's your sofa? Where's your book? She put a book in his head. There's plenty of time in the next world for resting. That's what she said to him. You'll have plenty of time to sit down and rest in the next world. I'm not letting you do that here. So he took a Torah book and put his hands. You learn while you're. I don't marry you to rest. Before you rush home and do this, you know who your husband is. That's what it is. I wish to also discuss Joseph and the brothers, because there you see an example of intense drawn-out suffering which ended in tremendous happiness. I'm not going to keep you later for that. That's a classic example of this idea. If you listen to the tape of last Monday night, at the end of that discussion, we try to go through that idea to show how in Torah there was a pathway of tremendous confused suffering, which in the end became a treasured, relished experience, because you see that it's that which brought you to this new level. But for today, let's leave it there. Yes, Hashem, next week.